Right, welcome to this meeting of the Consistent Democrats, public-hosted or semi-public-hosted meeting. And this week it will be on the question of United Fronts versus Popular Fronts and what the meaning of that sort of distinction is. I mean, this is a crucially important topic. And the United Front is a vital necessity for those struggling against any form of class exploitation or indeed extra class oppression. And it's something that communists always fight for as a matter of principle when we're involved in a class struggle. And for looking at the reasons for that, it's worth revisiting Marx and Engels and the Communist Manifesto to look into the roots of it. There's a passage in that which is titled "The Proletarians and Communists," and they give a certain rendition of what this is all about. They say, "In what relation do the communists stand to the proletarians as a whole? The communists do not form a separate party opposed to the other working class parties. They have no interest separate and apart from those of the proletariat as a whole. They do not set up any sectarian principles of their own by which to shape and mould the proletarian movement. The communists are distinguished from the other working class parties by this only. One, in the national struggles of the proletarians of the different countries, they point out and bring to the front the common interests of the entire proletariat, independently of all nationality. Two, in the various stages of development which the struggle of the working class against the bourgeoisie has to pass through, they always and everywhere represent the interests of the movement as a whole. The communists, therefore, are on the one hand practically the most advanced and resolute section of the working class parties of every country, that section which pushes forward all others. On the other hand, theoretically, they have over the great mass of the proletariat the advantage of clearly understanding the line of march, the conditions, and the ultimate general results of the proletarian movement." And I would argue that is the essence of the communist tactics in the United Front. We are the firmest advocates of unity in action of working class forces. We apply this to mass trade unions, to parties that claim to stand for the interests of the working class, and et cetera, anything else that's relevant to this topic. We argue for unity in action of all forces that have an interest in a struggle, irrespective of particular political views. And operationally, the political views of those who involve themselves in a struggle ought to be irrelevant. Rarely will a united front involve a single discrete action. Usually it involves a series of actions in pursuit of a particular objective. And that objective might be ongoing. For instance, it could be to organize regular demonstrations against the imperialist proxy war in Ukraine. That is a united front that we are currently involved in, and we have been for quite a few years, actually, which is called International Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity. We champion the rights of all those who involve themselves in such a struggle to argue their own views about the way it's conducted. And the only restriction on that is practical. If we're involved in a life or death struggle or an action right now, an outbreak of discussion during the action is likely to derail that action. But as soon as the action is carried out, there must be full freedom to criticise it, and the conduct of all involved in it by all who are involved. I mean, that is a basic point about that. It's particularly relevant when we're talking about the participation in struggles of political formations that have some sort of class contradiction within them, such as bourgeois workers' parties like the Labour Party, which are likely to have elements in the leadership who are hostile to the aims of a particular struggle. You can give examples. There's two very good examples. One is the struggle against British troops in Ireland. Another is the struggle against the Iraq War, because it was the Labour Party that sent British troops into Ireland in 1969. I know that's a past issue now, but nevertheless, it's important. And it was the Labour Party under Tony Blair that invaded Iraq. And at the same time, there are elements in the Labour Party on its left wing who oppose these things and might want to join in a united front against them. We welcome their participation and seek to encourage and deepen their involvement in the struggle. That's a key part of the non-sectarian unity in action ethos of the United Front and our participation in it. And the aim of that is that the bigger platform with more diverse forces involved will attract greater numbers of previously uninvolved masses to take part in the struggle. But this is where freedom of criticism becomes absolutely crucial. The presence of left reformists and the like not only expands the scope of those likely to be drawn into a struggle, it also has the potential to undermine it, because those from the reformist party that support the struggle also have party loyalties to the party leadership that may well be the main antagonists of the struggle. And they may not want to burn their bridges within the party or risk being thrown out of it. They may also have their own qualms about the radical tactics, the mass actions that are necessary to really win the struggle and defeat their own party leadership. So, or on the other hand, there may be a party in opposition that verbally supports the struggle and yet has similar qualms about the actions that are necessary to win. You know, and that's where freedom of criticism is crucial. Now, it is communist criticism. The communists must be free to expose these inadequacies of their bloc partners and allies to all those who've been drawn into the struggle. Sometimes, at such a point, the reformists will take offence and they'll violate the ethos of freedom of criticism. They'll attempt to impose a discipline on the participants in the United Front to stop such criticism. And if that happens, the continuation of the United Front may become unprincipled, and it may be necessary for the communists to break it, to break the discipline, this so-called discipline that the reformists attempt to impose, to expose such treachery to the objectives of the struggle itself. And there's nothing wrong with breaking a United Front, with breaking with it, if there are sufficient reasons to do so. And such a break by the communists can become a living factor in itself. It can put increased political pressure on the more right-wing participants in the United Front and lead to the re-establishment of the United Front later on a healthier basis. You know, that's a possibility. That would be a political debate, a political defeat for the right wing. You know, and the failure to do this in some ways brings us onto the topic of what a popular front is. Because you know, a united front does not necessarily exclude all bourgeois elements. You know, you could have a united front to defend a political prisoner, you know, or against an attack on gay rights, for instance, that may attract a degree of bourgeois support. And that's actually just fine, provided you get full freedom of criticism maintained, you know. And it's when that happens, it's when that's not, you know, that's not in the situation that the problem of popular frontism actually begins. For instance, a particular high level of United Front may be a campaign to elect to office the candidates of a working class party, even one with a partially bourgeois program like the Labour Party. And it may well be that communists will participate in such an election campaign and seek to push the reformist party into power so its promises can be tested before the masses to see whether it will really fight for them or whether it will betray them in power. And it's obvious that the communists will demand full freedom of criticism of the reformists both during the election and afterwards, which is particularly relevant if the party that we are fighting to elect actually gets elected. And that can be almost the ideal situation for a substantial revolutionary organisation to begin to really grow, you know. And such situations are ideal, but they actually sometimes been quite rare, at least in recent years, you know. But there are other situations where the reformists are not so keen to be thrust into office alone. They either do not have enough support and are looking for a shortcut, or they're looking for an alibi to excuse whatever treachery they may do in power, you know. And that's the starting point of a popular front on the electoral and governmental level. Now, there are also popular frontist blocs possible on a non-electoral level, which I'll talk about in a little while. So in that situation, the reformist bourgeois workers' party will run for office in a bloc with some sort of outright bourgeois party, for instance, Liberal Democrats or Greens or something similar. Or on the other hand, you might see a situation where a small reformist party might try to hang on the coattails of a much larger bourgeois party, using the excuse that it needs to get some degree of power, even though it doesn't have enough support to be elected outright. And that's the kind of politics you see in the United States with the Democratic Socialists of America, or Bernie Sanders, and such like, you know. And our position is that we don't support such blocs. If a working class party doesn't have enough support to win an election in their own name, that's tough. You know, the masses need to gain more experience of the way the capitalist system works to propel them to support a working class party next time. You know, we don't support opportunist blocs for government with bourgeois forces. To campaign for such blocs in elections is a breach of the principle of class independence. Now, it's possible in some circumstances when the reformist party does have enough support to take power, but engages in rotten attempts to make an agreement with bourgeois parties, for the masses to use their own independent electoral tactic to force the reformists to take power without their bourgeois bloc partners. And that could happen when the masses refuse to vote for the bloc partners of the reformists have instructed them to vote for, and instead vote for only for the reformists, thus sabotaging the bloc. And that actually happened in France in 1936, when Léon Blum, who's the leader of the French Socialist Party, the SFIO, was forced to take office when the actual plan of the Popular Front was to put Daladier or Herriot, two leaders of the Bourgeois Radical Party, into office as Prime Minister. But Blum was actually put there basically because the masses refused to vote for the radicals, but voted for the Socialist and Communist Party, you know. And that was truly a revolutionary event. As soon as Blum was actually forced to take office in this way, his new government was greeted by the most enormous general strike in French history. His aim was to hold him to his promises. You know, that was a remarkable event, a truly exceptional situation, where the mass sabotage of a popular front gave birth to a revolutionary situation. But more generally, the danger of a popular front, if it succeeds in gaining power by that strategy, is that it gives the reformists an excuse to betray what they stand for. Because they tell the masses that, quote, we would like to do more, but our coalition partners will not allow us to do so. And that erects a barrier to political radicalization, as the masses can be fooled to accept this supposed logic and therefore become demoralized. And that creates the political space for a far-right attack on the workers' movement itself, for a rise of fascism or a military coup, like in Chile in 1973, or something similar. So we never support such blocs. It's better for the workers' parties to be out of power than involved in such insidious class collaborationist blocs, which lay out a road that really they lay out a road to power for fascism, if anything. And there are also smaller scale popular front type bodies that do not seek governmental power per se, but still play an insidious role in rejecting the struggle against aspects of capitalist reaction. And I'm thinking of formations like the Anti-Nazi League, which use the ideology of classless anti-Nazism to fight the rise of the National Front in the late 70s. So you see Unite Against Fascism or Stand Up to Racism today. Again, they have the same, the SWP is the main organizer of these blocs. It should be remembered that in 1977, the SWP led mass actions against the National Front, which was a large, growing and threatening fascist party in the 70s, particularly in the period of the 1974-79 Labour government of Harold Wilson and then James Callaghan. So they led the mass actions against the National Front in August 1977 in Lewisham, and then Ladywood in Birmingham 3 days later. There are actually thousands of left-wing and working-class people turned and smashed National Front marches off the streets, basically. You know, the problem is that those demonstrations didn't have the real protection of trade union involvement and endorsement. And the SWP were left somewhat exposed because they'd actually gone out and done this. And there was a little element of substitutionism about it. So they really were exposed to a massive witch hunt in the media against the SWP in particular, who were actually equated with terrorists by some of the media. And there was the possibility was mooted that the SWP might be banned, actually. After that, they initiated the Anti-Nazi League later in 1977, and it was a much broader body. It had sponsors, including the Labour Party. It had football managers like Brian Clough. It had the Young Liberals and their very well-known anti-apartheid activist, Peter Hain, who later joined Labour and became a minister under Tony Blair, actually. But they appear to have even tried and failed to get the sponsorship of the Federation of Conservative Students for the Anti-Nazi League. But, what was important was what the effect that the Anti-Nazi League had on anti-fascist struggles, because their strategy was to jointly organise carnivals with Rock Against Racism. Which Rock Against Racism was a worthwhile endeavour in trying to inject anti-racist and anti- and left-wing politics into popular music. It was excellent. You know, nothing wrong with the idea. Yeah, but the problem is that the carnivals they organised were also part of a search for more respectability. So both of the two major anti-Nazi League carnivals in 1978 were held a long way away from the prime areas where the National Front were mobilising, which in London at the time was particularly around Brick Lane. You know, so there were two carnivals held in 1978. One was in April in Victoria Park in Hackney, and one was in Brockwell Park in Brixton in September. And for the whole of that period, the National Front were terrorising Brick Lane, actually. It was the sharp end of their concentrated attack on the new Bengali communities that were forming up in the East End, particularly in Tower Hamlets and Newham. So there was a huge problem. On these occasions, the Anti-Nazi League and Rock Against Racism managed to mobilise over 100,000 anti-fascists to go to Hackney and later Brixton, while the National Front were terrorising Brick Lane. And they had the ability to do it differently and swamp the National Front and wreck their activities there if they wanted to. But respectability stopped them. Now, the second Anti-Nazi League carnival was the first demonstration I ever went on. You know, I was only 17 years old then. And the Spartacist League, to their credit, they mass leafleted carnival goers earlier on in the day, asking them to go to Brick Lane and join the mobilisation against the fascists there, instead of singing and dancing about mobilising against the fascists. But I think with a bit of flexibility and initiative from the SWP, they could have done both, you know. But they didn't was an indictment of the SWP sinking into popular frontism in response to a witch hunt. The Anti-Nazi League didn't stop all serious protests against fascism, though. You know, I mean, one important such battle was during the general election in 1979 in Southall, where a large mobilisation of anti-fascists against the National Front event was battered by the cops, you know, resulting in the murder of Blair Peach, who was a local teacher and an SWP member, which was an appalling action. But I think this is weaker than it could have been, simply because of what they'd done before, because of their popular front attitude. They'd somewhat demobilised the things, and maybe the police wouldn't have dared to do that if they had, you know, maintained a correct position, you know. And you can see the fruits of this today with the subsequent popular front anti-fascist campaigns that the SWP have initiated, like Unite Against Fascism, which had David Cameron as one of its endorsers, you know, or Stand Up to Racism, which insists, in some parts of the country, insists on including Zionists on its marches to demonstrate its opposition to so-called anti-Semitism, you know. And I think that's not how the left should organise against fascism. And Trotsky's, you know, just going back to the United Front, Trotsky's writings on the United Front against fascism in the 1930s are exemplary as he sought to actually unite the communist and socialist parties in Germany, his struggle against Hitler, basically physical struggle to prevent the rise of Hitler. Of course, he was not listened to, and Hitler did actually manage to get to power. But the SWP doesn't follow that example. It builds respectable blocks with ruling class elements that resemble Popular Front campaigns from that period. I mean, it's not really about the SWP. It's about Popular Front in general and what's wrong with it. But I think that's a particular salient example in Britain. And I think it's something that really does illustrate what the issue is. I think I'll leave it there because that's really the most concrete example we have right in front of our eyes, as it were, as to the an example of Popular Frontism here. But I'll open it up for discussion. I'll conclude there. Thank you. Who wants to speak? Paul.
I wasn't aware of just how far back.
You're a bit quiet. I think.
Can you hear me now?
A bit, but it's a bit quiet. Not sure why. Are you outside?
come back to me.
Who else wants to speak? Simon.
Okay, I'll start this and put it in kind of two or three sections. So just to paraphrase the primary essence of what you're saying is that a united front does not necessarily reject all bourgeois elements. It's that is fine if there is full freedom of criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you start compromising on that, then you're on the slippery slope towards what could be described as Popular Frontism. Okay, then maybe later we might hear some of John's experiences from the Time to Go movement. You were talking about the ANL and some of the issues historically and how they are echoed by Stand Up to Racism today. I just wanted to know if you had anything to say about the differences between, say, the Troops Out movement. I mean, I really don't know anything too much about them. Time to Go. And then the Irish Freedom Movement, which was the RCP's kind of initiative. Were they trying to create a united front with that, or was that following their kind of red front kind of theory, which seemed to imply that a united front and a popular front are no longer kind of applicable to that specific period of history? So I'm quite interested in general about how we relate to other groups. So are you saying that you would not participate in Stand Up to Racism initiatives, or you would? Well, how do you actually interject? How do you kind of intervene in those kinds of groups? And how would you kind of take a position on groups like Anti-Fascist Action, which are presented as something of an alternative to this kind of soft united front stroke popular front kind of formation that the SWP have? And just one final point on the Zionists demonstrations. A couple of Zionists did turn up at the Westcliff demonstration that was called 2 or 3, 4 weeks ago. And we had seen them on a counter demonstration against the pro-Palestine demonstration in Southend town centre. They certainly weren't invited by Stand Up to Racism. I was just wondering, what would you advocate we do in such circumstances? These are people that have been on a very reactionary counter demonstration. Then all of a sudden they were just there, joining with us on a demonstration against the 50 or so fascists that did turn up that night to hope it. They were hoping to carry out a pogrom against a solicitor's office. So what would you say to that? So there's two or three things that I can remember all those.
Paul, you want to come back?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah. I don't know what happened to you.
Yeah, I changed the mic. with the Popular Funding, we had this issue in Oxford recently, where stand-up to racism effectively, rather embarrassingly for them, they effectively tried to control the parameters of the speeches, one of which was caught on video, where there was a Muslim American woman who was making a speech, and at some point she started the chant of Free Palestine, and at which point the megaphone was flipped off, and she was told in no uncertain terms that it wasn't a Palestine demonstration. And this isn't the only incident involving Oxford Stand Up to Racism. And even on the same day, Gabu Naylor Hurtley, who was the Oxford East Pack, the independent candidate for Oxford East, chose not to bother speaking in the end because they were already questioned about what she was due to speak about, and this is clearly a symptom of what one would describe as this popular frontism, and in my view. And of course, the link between Zionists and Stand Up to Racism in Glasgow is now well documented by Tony Greenstein and a few Glaswegian socialists that were some of us are that work alongside. In Glasgow, what they did was they effectively have their own anti-racist organisation, who basically counter to some extent the standards of racism demonstration. My own objection to standard to racism would be that by all means go on their events, and I've noticed now that they do attempt to hold trade union meetings with their motions. We had one of those the other day in my own branch, but what I wouldn't advocate, and sometimes their motions do, sometimes they put forward model motions, which is really SWP putting this forward, is that they have model motions where they attempt to get trade union branches to affiliate, and I certainly wouldn't agree, personally, I wouldn't agree with affiliating to them because of the sort of soft relationship with Zionists. I think anything that has Zionists as part of its campaigning is going to end up with problems in the long run. And I think Zionists, no matter how progressive some of them might think they might be, will eventually lead to the undermining of that particular campaign. We've seen it in the Labour Party with people like John Lambman, and I think we're going to have the same problem with this new collective that supported a bunch of independents. Anyway, I stop there because I'm going a bit white. Thanks.
Sure. Anybody else want to speak? If not, I'll come in briefly on responding to some of Simon's points. My view of the troops are active, but I've got no problem with it. I mean, it, as it was, I don't know if it's still very active. I suspect not, in the right of what's happened in Ireland and the dying down of that struggle. But I was actually involved in the troops out movement. I left it when I joined the Spartacist League, which was a mistake, actually. I joined the Spartacist League in 1980 and left the troops out movement because we didn't agree with their second slogan. And I think we should have done. But I mean, that's that was my mistake when I was young. So I would, my excuse is that I was young and I was aspiring to be an Orthodox Trotskyist, and I was mistakenly believed that the Sparts were that, and they were a bit more complicated than that. But yeah, I've got no problem with it. It's a straightforward united front campaign around Ireland. Troops out now, self-determination for the Irish people as a whole. Those are principled demands. It's just as principled as what we're doing with the IUAFS, you know. And I think that, you know, that I regret not being involved in it for a long period in the 80s and 90s, when it was a really very, very, you know, live question. It's, as I said, it's died down now because the situation in Ireland has been sort of readjusted by imperialism and well, those movements have sort of fizzled out. You can argue about why, but that's a different question. Regarding Time to Go, that was a popular front in its intention. Its intention was to water down the demand for troops out now, to get something a bit more nebulous, to get liberals and you know, the Liberal Party, actually. It was the Liberal Party at the time, wasn't it? Not the Liberal Democrats, before the Liberal Democrats were created. But that was the purpose of it, to get young liberals, the same young liberals, around Peter Hayne and his left-wing reputation, which is a pretty good left-wing reputation, but there's still a bourgeois party. And that was the aim of Time to Go, as I understand it. It was an initiative of the SWP and possibly of the IMG as well. I can't quite remember. But yeah, we would be critical of that. We would not have endorsed that. We would have endorsed a troops out movement, but we would not have endorsed that, you know. Regarding the Irish Freedom Movement, I think that was a red front. Yes, there was a sectarian RCP initiative, and we all know what the RCP has become. You know, they were a very strange group, and they would take up an issue, they would organise in a pristine manner around their interpretation of it, which was probably not that bad, but it was in that particular case, because it was actually politically quite similar to the Troops Out movement, except it had this radical sounding edge about it, and it was set up in direct competition with it. It claimed to be more principled, but it's a bit nebulous in what way it was supposedly more principled. But that was its image that it tried to project anyway. But I think the RCP were a bunch of shysters, and they always were. And the fact that they've ended up on the Tory right indicates that. I mean, how can you go from being supposedly the left of the left to ending up on the Tory right? It's really very, very strange history, you know. I agree. Yeah, you know, I think what Paul said about the stand up to racism and Zionists is just true. You know, I mean, I don't know exactly what the situation was in Southend, but they have been known to shut people up. You know, Palestine activists have been told to shut up, basically, around in different parts of the country. Let's just mute Max. Sorry about that. That always happens. But yeah, they silence Palestine activists in order to appease Zionists, and that's been repeated across the country. You know, that incident was caught on film where they shut that woman up who was talking about Palestine, and she wasn't just chanting Free Palestine. She was also talking about the issue. She started to talk about it in her speech as a question of anti-racism, which of course it is. And immediately she did that, they tried to shut her up. And she wouldn't shut up, to her great credit. And they were forced to allow her to continue, but only after considerable protest from the crowd. And it's a disgrace, because Palestine, if anything's an anti-racist struggle today, it's Palestine. You cannot separate them from everything else. Certainly the EDL don't separate them, do they? You know, so, you know, it's just terrible. You know, I think, how do you deal with
Zionists?
You know, well, you tell them to F off, basically. I mean, if they don't, I mean, they're not going to physically throw them away, throw them out necessarily. if they're not behaving, you know, in a provocative or dangerous manner. But we're not going to allow them to speak on platforms or anything, and we prefer they go away, to be honest. I think that should be our attitude to them. If they behave themselves, they might be allowed to listen and watch the rally or something. If they don't behave themselves, we're physically driving them away. That should be the attitude to Zionists, in my opinion. You know, not all Zionists are fascists, but some of them are, and you need to be very, very careful about them. That's my view, anyway. Sorry. Anybody else wants to speak? Hello, Max, by the way. Sorry, I did mute you because your machine was going crazy.
Okay, hi. I don't know why I can't get video, but hello. Well, I'm just going to sit back a bit.
Cheers. Anyway, who wants to speak?
By the way, look, we were talking about two different events. The one I'm referring to was in Oxford, not self-offence.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, I know. I'm referring to what Simon says. Yeah.
Oh, I see. The incident in Oxford, the person in question did put out a goblin apology. The cover is that wasn't the only incident that person was involved with. And to some extent, I think that one or two of the individuals does have a bit of a problem with Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
This came out in an Oxford Socialist Community WhatsApp group I'm in, and that's where the video was released and then shared around. And someone said about the woman that was speaking, to say that she, but there are nuances to this. Apparently this woman runs a Facebook group called Muslim Girl, which I found actually. And this person was arguing that this woman has certain issues that other comrades would have issues with. And having looked at that page, I couldn't see anything untoward. So I think the person that tried to justify what happened was frankly being a bit creepy. You know, they were buying into basically anti-Islamic quotes, effectively. So, you know, so I think there were some people involved in some branches of stand-up for racism who are not as anti-racist as some people might think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think some are on a bit of a journey, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. Anybody else wants to speak? Anybody else? Simon, yeah.
Yeah, just to reiterate, would and how would your characterization of the United Front and the Popular Front, how would it relate to groups that have got a lot of anarchist kind of participation, like Antifa, anti-fascist action?
Yes, that's what I forgot to answer.
Yeah, anti-fascist action, you know, is quite interesting. Apparently, Jeremy Corbyn was at the first launch meeting of that. Along with groups like Workers' Power, Red Front, and a lot of anarchist groups. And it's got a bit of a weird history, not quite like the RCP and stuff in different ways. But I do remember reading a very an article in which the author was very perplexed, saying he'd been over to the Czech Republic to help establish branches of Antifa in the Czech Republic, and was astounded that every anarchist he came across that were interested in setting this up said that class did not exist. It was a redundant term. That is an extreme example because of the peculiarities of post-89 East Central Europe. But yeah, have you got any thoughts about that? Any sort of clarifications?
Can I come back on that? Just actually, I have, because I actually was involved in APA for a little while, because I was sort of, when I was at, sort of in Birmingham after I had, well, I left the Sparks, I had a bad personal situation, which I won't go into. I got sort of, I spent a lot of time talking to Workers' Power, and I did get involved in some APA stuff, you know, in some pickets and things, and they were all right, actually. I think they were a united front, albeit a united front without a correct Marxist component in them. But they were not that bad at all, you know. They did carry out real anti-fascist work. I've got no real problem with them. I think they were a little bit politically unstable because of some of the anarchist types were a bit sort of flighty, and they tended to wander off in different directions and things. But the actual anti-fascist action was all right. Workers' Power did some quite good work with them, you know, when Workers' Power was a worthwhile group and had some stability, you know. And they were quite sizable, actually, Workers' Power, about 100 people at their peak, you know, in the late 80s. So actually, yes, I think it was not so bad. I'm not hostile to it. If it was around today, we'd probably be involved in it, you know. It's not really around today, though. But, yeah, I'm not hostile to that at all, actually. It's certainly not a popular front. It was a bit of a united front type body, you know. It was probably not as well led as it could have been, but that's all I can say about it, really. I'm not going to slag it off, you know. Its intention was good anyway. You know, that's my view. Anybody else? I'm surprised. I thought this would actually provoke more controversy. John, yeah.
Yeah, just briefly. I mean, again, I mean, I'd like to ask Jack Conrad, but he said in a meeting he wasn't convinced by Trotsky's 1930s writings on the United Front. Right. He's not sure it would have seen fascism or. Now, I don't know what he bases that on, but that would be quite interesting to know what he means by that.
I don't know. He's got strange views on some things, to be honest. I don't know really what he's talking about.
Well, we shouldn't take, you know, Trotsky's writings as gospel, you know. Oh, they're not, you know. That they're not beyond criticism, or mm-hmm. you know, maybe that, you know, but I don't know
what he means, that's the thing.
But I'll have to ask him if I see him, you know, what he meant by that. But you know,
sure. Anybody else want to speak? Okay. What should we do then? Should we go on to any other business if everybody's had their say? It's a bit early. I was expecting a more prolonged discussion, but you want to speak, Max?
Yeah. Workers' Power. What part? What does that correspond to in the United States? Is that like Socialist Action?
Fifth International.
Fifth International. They had one of those groups here in New York. I don't know if it still exists. It's something for the Fifth International.
I'm not sure.
Very bad, but very small. I mean,
it's always hard to keep track of.
Do you have a branch of Socialist Action, you know, the Mackler group here in the United States?
No, we
split
don't.
Split in 83.
There is a group called Socialist
Action. What?
Let me just explain. There is a group here called Socialist Action, but I don't think it's anything to do with the Socialist Action in the U.S.
Right. That's the problem. They have the same. The ones that have the same name are not the same thing. That's usually the case. It's hard to keep track when you don't. But yeah. I did have some experience with groups like that. Socialist Action in the United States I felt like kind of what you were saying about workers' taxes. Yeah, they're all right, you know. They're actually trying, their heart's in the right place kind of thing. I had a very good comrade named Marty Goodman in New York who died back in March. You know, people from all different, well, mostly union people and socialist action. But there was, at his memorial a couple of months ago, there were people from the internationalist group and, you know, there were all kinds of different socialists there. So, you know, it proves that, you know, sometimes a group might not be perfect, but they're doing something. And but the question of United Front versus Popular Front was always big, and they thought they were doing it right. But groups like that, I also agree with, like Bolshevik Tendency or some other, I'm not sure which one, some split from the Sparts, had a good article criticizing socialist action back in the 80s because they said they carried the bags for imperialism. Sometimes it's, if you haven't actually experienced what those people were doing at that moment, it's hard to know who's right. That might be a good argument, but I'm curious about all these issues, especially these groups that kind of like would side against, you know, in the 80s, would side with Solidarnosc or Solidarity Union against, you know, against the Soviet state or whatever you want to call it, because, you know, this happens a lot in ostensibly Trotskyist groups, where they sort of, especially around the fall of the Soviet Union, where they there's this tendency in many groups. There's some in Brazil. I had a comrade in Brazil who's always jumping from one group to another. But his thing was, oh, we thought that the fall of the, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union was a positive thing because it was getting rid of Stalinism. You know, that whole argument, which I don't really, I see where they're coming from, but I don't agree with that. I think it was a bad thing, you know. Mm-hmm. For obvious reasons, but anyway, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if you have groups like that, that especially around Poland in the 80s, and, you know, because the clerical reaction used the union movement, so it looked like a genuine workers' movement, but it was co-opted by these reactionaries. You know, it's a complicated issue. Anyway, I'll stop talking. I can't get my camera to work for some reason. I really. It's not by choice that you can't see me. Anyway.
Okay, fair. Susan wants something to. Yeah, Susan.
Yeah, it's just to say, in your experience, which, you know, the real class enemy is the ruling class, if you like, and the bourgeoisie who support them. But which do they find easier to undermine and to destroy, United Fronts or Popular Fronts? And the reason I ask is that, in effect, in the last sort of 30 or 40 years, we've seen in the West, whether it's America or UK or Europe, a variety of both of those actions, whether there are United Fronts and there have been Popular Fronts. But which one do the ruling class find it easier to fight back against? Because it seems to me in the last 10 years, the bogeyman for them has been what I'd call the popular leaders. You know, the charismatic leaders, the leaders who can bring people together. And that's where them, you know, not just Jeremy Corbyn, but all sorts of charismatic leaders across the world are either being undermined or politically or actually physically destroyed. You know, you look at the coups against Traore, these popular people, leaders who attract people, who are really being targeted in the most appalling way.
Yeah. Just can I briefly answer that?
Please do. Yes, I'm just intrigued at how you.
Briefly, I mean, I think the ruling class does not have a problem with popular fronts. They're a tool for the ruling class to undermine the working class movement. So actually, they quite welcome them in some situations. Even in France, what the popular front that's been created has done, though it seems to have won the election and everything like that, it's actually undermined the left in a way. because, you know, because the left was pushed into a block with Macron, effectively, to try and stave off Le Pen. Le Pen actually got more votes in the second round of the French legislative elections a couple of months ago than the Popular Front did, the new Popular Front that was initiated by Mélenchon, you know. The Le Penists got more votes, even though they didn't get more seats. So it actually gives them kudos. It actually, in the end, that just kicked the can down the road, didn't it? It didn't solve the problem, you know. I think that the ruling class does fear a genuine united front of the working class movement, and it will do everything to try and sabotage it. And that is precisely why they went for Corbyn, actually, because Corbyn had that potential to lead the working class movement in a more or less straightforward class against class manner. And in fact, what happened in the general election in 2017 was a class against class vote. You saw the Tories get 43% and the Labour Party get 41.5%. I can't remember the exact figures. You know, that was a very, very high vote for both parties and a class polarisation. Whereas in other situations, you see that there's fragments of all over the place. Starmer does not represent a class vote. He got lower votes than Corbyn did when he lost the election in 2019. He got half a million fewer votes. That was not a class vote, quite clearly. That was a fragmented vote in which a number of the people actually voted for Starmer because he was a better Tory than the Tories. And that's what he actually tried to project. You know, so I think they do fear a united front of the working class. They will do everything to try and sabotage it. And that's why they went for Corbyn. As to people like Traoré or whatever, I mean, that's a slightly different question. That's in countries with very little proletariat, actually. And you're talking about anti-imperialist figures who are struggling against imperialist domination. I think that's a slightly different question. We have a position of an anti-imperialist united front with such people, which is slightly outside the framework of this discussion, you know, though it does apply in around the world, actually, you know. But I think that the ruling class prefers a popular front. The popular front is a weapon of the ruling class, really. And it's a way of undermining the workers' movement and paving the way for a reactionary development, like a coup or a rise of fascism or something, you know. So I very much think that the ruling class does not like the United Front at all. Sorry, John wants to come back.
Yeah, I just want to say, I think the reason we have difficulty discussing this is because, you know, there are very few groups who've effectively implemented a united front. It's easy to criticize the SWP and all that, but you know what did, you know, Workers' Power's tiny group, all these Trotskyist groups are tiny in mainly insignificant groups. So you know how the united front, we've never, it's like just something that hasn't been used, right? And we haven't seen it in action at all, because most of the groups who have advocated the United Front, who like Workers' Power and the Sparks and one or two other groups, they don't really exist as a force. So what there are very few practical examples we can point to where the United Front has been used effectively, because most of the left Trotskyist groups that have headed movements, right, have often not implemented what the rest see as a united front. For example, the Anti-Nazi League or Time to Go, right? It's a much disputed area, and the thing about it is, I mean, I don't know much about the Vietnam War campaign, but that would be an interesting one to look at. But the Fourth International, as far as I know, were involved significantly in the anti-Vietnam War campaign, right? But a lot of Trotskyist groups would say, but they don't implement the United Front, you know. So and you know, what was the anti-Vietnam War campaign? Was that a United Front, or was it a Popular Front, or was it, you know, these things? It's not always clear, you know, because of the fact that rarely has there been a Trotskyist group. They've only operated it on very small scale things like workers' power, like during the Time to Go thing. Workers' power had the anti-imperialist section of it, which I think was probably a good idea, you know, but it didn't make much of a impact on the thing. So most of it where they've tried to implement it has been irrelevant. So we can't really point to examples where the United Front has been operated and what its shortcomings might be and that sort of thing. I mean, the Vietnam campaign, that was led by one of the main people was Tariq Ali. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the Trotskyist groups I'm thinking of would say, well, he's not a traditional Trotskyist, you know? So, you know, there are all sorts of questions there, and I'll leave it there.
Paul?
Yeah, my answer to Susan's point would have been that a Popular Front would be easier to undermine than a United Front, because it already has four quasi elements within it. So at some point, if it becomes too broad, those bourgeoisie elements are going to be the very people that undermine the campaign. So that would be my answer to that one.
Just can I come back very briefly in response to John? Who's implemented the United Front? I don't think anybody has really done it properly, but there are people who've attempted to do it in some situations quite well. The Sparks, for instance, in the United States had led some quite great, in their earlier period, in the 80s, led some quite good anti-fascist United Fronts, and lots of endorsements from trade union bodies and whatever. The one in Washington in 1982, I think it was, had about 1,700 people that actually chased the Ku Klux Klan out of Washington. There was a couple of others, one in Detroit, one in, I can't remember. The problem with the Sparks is they are very, very rigid about what they will call a united front. I mean, they probably wouldn't have got involved in the troops out movement, even though they agreed with it, because they think it's a propaganda block. I think that's a distinction that really is rather academic, and you know, they say a united front will be one action, right? And we won't have an ongoing series of actions. We won't get involved in an ongoing block to organise a whole load of actions, because that's a propaganda block. That's not a united front. That's their rigidity and their problem. You know, they're wrong about that, in my opinion. But they did some quite credible anti-fascist united fronts on an individualist basis in the 80s. You know, I think workers' power in anti-fascist action were not so bad. You know, I don't know who else. The Healyites in the 60s organised some sort of strike against the Vietnam War in the Liverpool docks. Well, exactly. Well, I suspect that was some sort of united front with trade union militants or something like that. I don't know. You know, the IBT or Howard Keeler organised a 10-day port shutdown in 1984 of a ship that was going to South Africa that was carrying arms to the South African regime. They had a united front with all sorts of people, with trade unionists and other political parties, in fact, like the Peace and Freedom Party on the West Coast, participated in that. You know, that was a very good united front. That was really excellent, you know. I mean, there are examples of people who've done it properly, probably not enough and episodically, but I give credit where it's due. If people do organise something well, if they do it properly, then fine. You know, what we need is an organisation that's more permanent, that does it on an ongoing basis and has the social weight to do these things. But building it is a long, slow, laborious process, as we all know. That's all I can say, really. Anyway. Anybody else want to speak? Clive, did you put your hand up? I think you're muted anyway. No, you're not correct. Okay, friend. If you want to speak, you're very welcome. Anybody else want to speak? No, seeing none. Should we go on to any other business then and stop the recording, if that's all right with comrades? Yeah? I'll stop this recording. Well.